And now it's Mick Napier without any delay.
Friends, I'm reminded of the sort of iconic situation that every American kid knows it. The guy who, what's his name, Thoreau, was sent to prison for not paying taxes. And I think it was Emerson came to visit him. And Emerson was a sort of straight, very respectable guy. And he said to Thoreau, "What are you doing in here?" And Thoreau said to him, "What are you doing out there?" This was a time when decent people were in prison for standing up to the authorities. And I think it's the flower of our generation that are in prison now, who have been industrially processed by a judge whom I will try to persuade you later is nothing more than a beast. And I think when you know the full story, it's an absolute imperative for us to take action, not just here in Sheffield, but up in Scotland and even beyond there. I want to talk very briefly about the horror, because I think most people here know the reason why these young men and a couple of women went to the Israeli embassy, but it's worth reminding ourselves. The intense complicity of the British government, which the new one will certainly continue, and how at home that inevitably means the use of legal and other means of repressing those who oppose these foreign crimes. But then I want to really go quickly to look at the reasons for hope, because I think there are fantastic reasons for hope that Israel has reached, I think, a tipping point. I'll try and defend that proposition later, and then I'll take a leaf out of the old American folk song and don't mourn, organise. Yeah? I think the first thing is that they went there spontaneously. They weren't members of any organisation. In fact, they're vulnerable precisely because they went there spontaneously, impelled by moral outrage at what they saw on the television. In my own case, we were organised when we took action against the Israeli cultural ambassadors who came to Edinburgh, and we entered into it confidently. When we were charged, we were delighted to be charged. When it was changed to a charge of racism, we just danced a jig, because this gave us a chance to call fantastic witnesses to show that far from us being racist, we were opposed to a monstrous apartheid system. And it just got better and better and better until the very end. In fact, I almost regret that it's over. I'll try and explain why. But friends, the horror. Calorie intake in Gaza is monitored by the Israelis very carefully. A friend of mine, Habib Malik, is very active in Islamic Relief. But everything they send into Gaza has to be checked in with the Israelis. The Israelis check every paperclip and everything. I don't think they allow paperclips. And everything that goes in, the Israelis know. So what goes in at Tel Rafah, they deduct from what is allowed to go in at Eretz. And at the end of the day, I'll tell you the good news and the bad news, or the bad news and the good news. When you contribute humanitarian aid, I've got a garage full of medical aid to go to Gaza. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference. The Israelis just take it off another ledger. But it makes an enormous difference to the Palestinians to know that they're not forgotten and that we are sending them that. So I think the result is entirely political, morale-building, solidarity, the notion that in the big prison, these young men in London prisons don't want to leave them to think that they're left alone, and so much so also for the biggest prison in the world, Gaza and Palestine as well. Very quickly, the calorie intake has been lowered by the Israelis quite systematically. Dov Weissglass was an advisor to Ariel Sharon. He said, "It's not as if we're going to starve them to death, we're just going to put them on a slimming diet." And Haaretz reported the whole cabinet chuckling when Dov Weissglass said this. He's quite a portly fellow himself. I went to Gaza in January 2008 when the Palestinians wonderfully blew a big hole in the wall between Gaza and Egypt. The bombs went off at 5 o'clock in the morning and this wall came tumbling down, a huge big section of it. I was in there 2 days later from Cairo, and what I saw was what Israelis don't want you to see. Terrible hunger, levels of privation that they've never known before. And it's all micromanaged. This isn't Haiti. This isn't an earthquake in China. It is micromanaged from a control centre in Israel and completely supported by the Egyptian regime and the British regime and the Americans and so on and so on. And it's a man-made and man-maintained horror up until this very, very minute. I stumbled over the wall at midnight. And my friend wasn't there to meet me, so he said, I said, "What? Where the hell are you?" He said, "Give your phone to somebody passing by." So I stumbled over the wall. It's midnight in Gaza. It's a nest of terrorists. We should all be terrified. The British government recommends that you don't go there. And I gave my phone to the first person that passed by, and he took me safely to where I wanted to go. Of course he did. The hospital. Gaza's dangerous. They're so bloody hospitable, right? You get so much green tea and so many, you get fed so much by people who don't have anything that there's too much of a sweet tooth. When I was there, I met Mr. Samir Al-Hams, and his story has to substitute for the whole horror of what's going on in Gaza. It's not exceptional. I made a wee film about it, and at the end of it, Mr. Al-Hams says, my story's not exceptional. Every family here in Rafah, he says, has suffered grievously under this occupation. His daughter was 13 years old, going to school. A sound bomb went off. She became disoriented. She went to within 100 yards of an Israeli checkpoint. The officer said, kill her. We know what the officer said because it was recorded and played on Israeli television. One soldier says to the officer, it's a frightened schoolgirl. He said, kill her. He says, kill anything in this area, even if it's 3 years old. Now think what you call soldiers who kill three-year-old children. It's played on Israeli television. You can check. I hope you don't believe me. I hope you go and check it. Then he went up to the wee girl. He'd brought her down with a couple of bullets, and he emptied a magazine of 15 bullets into her to confirm the kill. He was quickly investigated because this was recorded. You know, like Gordon Brown says something about a woman, a bigot and so on. Or Ronald Reagan gets caught on microphone, he doesn't realise it's on, and he announces World War III. It's, you know, it's unusual when you're caught on a microphone. Well, these soldiers were caught on record. Very few Israeli soldiers are. So there was the most cursory of investigations. The officer was quickly found not guilty of any unethical conduct. It's ethical in the Israeli army to kill three-year-old children and to butcher a young girl lying on the ground. It's ethical. He was promoted to major very soon afterwards. And for the trauma of being investigated ever so briefly before he was found ethical, he was awarded 100,000 shekels in damages. So I spoke to Mr. Samir Al-Hams, and he told me all about it, and he told me what his family had been through and what the whole area had been through. You might not believe Mr. Al-Hams, he's a very dignified, wonderful man, a school teacher in Rafah camp, but Chris Hedges won a Pulitzer Prize for international journalism. He wrote an article in Harper's Magazine in 2001 from Rafah, the same place. And he describes what he saw. He said, I've travelled the world. I've seen women and children lined up and butchered in Guatemala. I said, I've seen them slaughtered in Algeria. But I've never anywhere in the world seen children teased into an open space and killed for sport. For sport, these children were killed. They would use their very loud PA system to shout, your mother's a whore, your sister's a whore. And the boys would come out and throw stones, and they would kill them, just there and then, just kill them, for fun. Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize winner of the Amnesty International Prize for Journalism for Human Rights. His Gaza diary is well worth reading. It's available out there. But you don't even need to believe Chris Hedges. You can go to Judge Goldstone. It's really there. I mean, it's there. Everybody who has half an eye and half an ear can find out what's happening. Goldstone's published it. Shots at old women to crumple them to the ground. People with white flags being shot dead. Getting all the people into a school with a building with the promise of safety, and then shelling it until they're all dead. It's all there in Goldstone. Crimes against humanity, grievous war crimes. And he doesn't just talk about Gaza. He talks about the years before, the deliberate manipulation of hunger. He doesn't just talk about Gaza. He talks about the West Bank, Jewish roads. For God's sake, do you know what a Jewish road is? Even in the most demented white supremacist in South Africa, didn't have white roads. They didn't have white roads. Anybody could drive on the road if they could get a jalopy together. They have Jewish-only roads in the West Bank. They crisscross the whole area. I've been on one for about 5 seconds in a Palestinian tractor. The guy said, I'm not going 20 miles. He just said, I'm going on the road. A jeep came around the corner, and he went off that road at high speed because he loses his paper, 6 months in prison possibly, and these swine were pointing their rifles at us as we scalped off over the fields. It's a Jewish-only road. And the whole West Bank defies vocabulary. There are 25-foot-high walls. There's a tunnel for Palestinians only to go into the town of Qalqilya. It's a big town. There's only one tunnel for Palestinians to go in and out. The Israelis of Bethlehem, if you go to church at Christmas and anybody sings Little Town of Bethlehem, interrupt them and say it's little huge prison of Bethlehem. Huge prison of Bethlehem. It's monstrous. If anybody sings that song in my hearing at Christmas, I'm going to have to interrupt. We can't find the vocabulary, because when you add up the walls, and then you add up the roads, and then you add up the checkpoints, and then you add up the piles of rubble, which aren't even manned, but are weapons of mass economic destruction to prevent wheel traffic and trade. The latter camp used to get dairy products from a wee village nearby. Piles of rubble. I dug one away and the Israelis came and forced people to put another one up. Just a pile of rubble. It's got no security implications whatsoever. It's to crush the Palestinian economy, and it's been going on for decades. I don't have the vocabulary to describe it. It's a diabolically new system of crushing people. And I'm reminded of the officer, Eitan, who was the governor of the southern, he was some military governor.
Rafael
Eitan. He says, when we have conquered the land, the Palestinians will be reduced like drugged cockroaches in a bottle, he said. They'll be like drugged cockroaches in a bottle. And that's the Israeli plan. It's vile. It's beyond language. It's unspeakable. And that's not the end of it. I'll finish the horror with this. We could go on and on for a very long time. But it's a funny story as well as horrible. Uri Davis is a good Jewish boy. He went to, 94% of Israel, 48-67, is off limits for Arabs. It's Jewish-only communities. You had white-only communities in South Africa and Mississippi, Alabama. Jews only. Uri Davis went and applied for a lease on a house in this community, being Jewish. He went to the committees, they asked him questions, he said, yeah, sure, okay. Okay, signs it, pays the money. There's the keys, Uri. Abdullah, here's the keys. He says, I'm an agent for Abdullah. It went up to the Israeli Supreme Court. Now, can you imagine if a black person moves into your street and it has to go up to the House of Lords? The neighbours are so virulent and so hateful. That's what happens. We're dealing with something very dark here, very, very dark indeed. And if you don't believe that, what's his name? Lieberman's in the cabinet. No, he's a Nazi, very simple, just a Nazi. He's far to the right of Hitler before Hitler came to power, or even after Hitler came to power in 1939. I was privileged on Saturday to meet Faisal, I forget his name. He's chairman of the Regional Council of Unrecognised Villages in the Negev, the Nerkab. An unrecognised village. They're the wrong kind of people. They don't get electricity, they don't get water. They don't even get put on the maps. It's a village. It's real people. But they're unrecognised. The state doesn't recognise them. Now, I know some anarchists who don't recognise the state, but I don't know a state around here that doesn't recognise the people. It's unspeakable. It's really new. It's sickeningly unique. Even in South Africa, the people were recognised. In 2009, New Year, you might be Christians, but I'm a bit of a pagan. And every hug me nay, I kind of go in for a bit of alcohol abuse, and we have a big party up in Scotland. It's the biggest thing of the year. But hug me nay 2009, I'll never forget, because from my house I can see Edinburgh Castle, and there's a huge fireworks display. It costs £500,000, it's to pack the hotels with tourists. And it was just monstrous, because I knew my friends were underneath the white phosphorus in Gaza. I knew they were being shelled with cluster bombs, diabolical weapons. You do know, don't you, that the Israelis use the people of Gaza as guinea pigs. In the international arms bazaars, they have an edge. They can outcompete the Chinese and the Brits. Tested on real people. Over many years, tested on real people. These diabolical little flechettes made of plastic that don't even turn up in x-rays. So I knew they were there. What a shit new year that was. The fireworks exploding. Right, you're trying to get to sleep and you see the fireworks and you know it's real napalm and real white phosphorus being dropped in your friends. And finally, it was the second time I'd been to Gaza. I went there briefly during the first intifada. And I tell you the story just so that you know how far back this goes. An Armenian took me to visit a hospital. I was working in the Middle East, went to Cairo, got the bus up to Gaza and then on to the West End, to the West Bank. Went to a hospital, there's a young woman lying in the bed, mother and father sitting beside her, she's smiling a wee bit, but she's not too happy. And they're saying, look, you're lucky to be alive, there's people dead, trying to cheer her up. And the Armenian translated and gave me the story. That morning, an Israeli patrol had come into her village and she was deaf. So she was frightened for her wee brother who was out there somewhere. These Palestinians, they send their children out to get killed just so the Israelis look bad. They're different from normal human beings, according to the Israelis. And she was terrified for her young brother. She went outside. The Israeli patrol told her to stop. Being deaf, she didn't hear it and came back into her house. Three soldiers came in, two held her down, and the officer put a rubber bullet, it's called, but it's steel, into both upper legs and broke both legs. The man who was responsible for that is Yitzhak Rabin. Now, you know Sharon's a beast. You know that Netanyahu spoke to a meeting of students and said, during the massacres in Tiananmen Square, that was our chance to get rid of the Palestinians. We should have ethnically cleansed all of them. That's the Prime Minister now, and you know Lieberman. But Rabin is a sainted man. The Liberal Democrats, you speak to them, my God, there's Mother Teresa and there's Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin was a war criminal. He ethnically cleansed. He obliterated villages. He drove out Palestinians. Horrendous individual, but canonised by some sections of British politics. He was the man who said, break their bones, he said. You know, the Israelis control the rate of killing. They control it. You know, they let it go up and then they bring it down again. Depends on the pressure they feel internationally. They don't get much pressure these days. And at that time, Rabin wanted to bring down the rate of killing. So he said, break their bones. And people thought, he just means be a bit tough. He meant break their bones. You can go on the internet and you'll see a photograph of Israeli soldiers holding a man down and breaking his arms with a big rock. They do that. That's nothing. Did you see the photograph recently? Just, it's very unusual of the officer with a blindfolded Palestinian shooting him in the foot. Mm-hmm. We saw that. That small change, that small beer in Palestine. Small beer. Very, hardly even worth mentioning. Anyway, that was my first visit to Gaza. Let's move on. The horror is the horror. But it's much worse because of British complicity. I'm not going to talk about Balfour, who gave away a country to somebody else. Before when Hitler was dousing in the street, right, and people would give him loose change, Britain gave Palestine to Zionists, to European colonists. What the hell am I going to give your house to somebody who's been abused in Manchester? No, people who've been abused deserve all the care and love we can give them. But I'm not going to kick you out of your house in order to accommodate them. The guards at Auschwitz didn't speak Arabic. Yet Britain gives Palestine to the Zionists. Balfour did it. Blair is still your official, my official Middle East peace envoy. Now your stomach might churn at the thought, but that's his job and he's still doing it. And he occupies a huge suite in the, I think it's the King David Colony Hotel in Jerusalem. He's a revolting creature. And he's the peace envoy. He's the peace envoy. He went to Gaza and he said, I think we can get peace here. He said, we have to close off the tunnels. That's the way to peace. It's out there. It's out there publicly. You know, the people in Gaza are in a huge prison and the Israelis shell them. They've got drones, they've got F-16s, they fire things from the sea. Remember the massacre of the family on the beach? Shell from warships. Not one day. My father was a miner. I know how difficult it is to dig a tunnel. Palestinian fighters dug a tunnel out of Gaza, under the ground, under the prison, under the walls, and they came up on the other side of an Israeli tank group. They killed a couple of soldiers, and they dragged one guy back into Gaza. You know why they dragged them back, don't you? They don't like pets. Because 10,000 Palestinians have been kidnapped by the Israelis and kept in prison camps and prisons, sometimes without trial. I think the longest serving is 35 years. There's a man in prison for 35 years. And the world doesn't even know his name.
Abdullah Barghouth.
They dragged this guy back. He was captured. He was a soldier. He's killing Palestinians and they managed to get a hold of him. I say good luck to them. I wish they could do it 100 times. And they dragged him back into Gaza, and Tony Blair went to Gaza. And you know what he said? Shut down the tunnels. We must free Gilad Shalit, he said. We demand the immediate release of Gilad Shalit. There's 10,000 Palestinian families. They say, what the hell about our loved ones? Is our blood lesser than Jewish blood? This is unspeakable. This is utterly off the scale of unspeakability. And Palestinians know it, by the way. They know it. If you mention the name Tony Blair, watch his lip. The lip curls. It's a lip curling thing, right? He's held in utter contempt and he's earned it many, many times over. So 10,000 prisoners, a matter of small import. One Israeli prisoner must be freed immediately. Settlements. And my final point before we go on to the hope is this is not just Brown and Cameron. You know, Cameron said the Israelis acted with great restraint in Gaza. Yeah, he said it. He said it. And in the last few days, you could not better him for the way he's prostrating himself before the state of Israel. I never thought anybody could beat Gordon Brown, but he seems to be competing. The BBC wouldn't even broadcast a humanitarian appeal. Blair's there rubbing salt in Palestinian wounds. Cameron is waiting to do even worse. The wall is illegal. Britain was enjoined to bring it down, has done nothing. Piracy. They hijacked a ship last year on the open sea. Six Brits were on it, one young woman from Edinburgh. I phoned my MP, I wrote to Miliband, they wouldn't use the word piracy. They wouldn't use the word abduction. They just wouldn't. Imagine the Iranians had kidnapped 15 Europeans, six Brits, and taken them forcibly to Iran. You couldn't open a newspaper without reading about it. The Israelis get a special card. Okay. But it's older, you know. The greatest living Briton, and I know you're proud to be British, I'm not. You're proud to be English, I think. I'm certainly not. And I'm certainly not proud to be Scottish either. It's just an accident of birth, right? But I do want to say this. The greatest living Briton in all the opinion polls is Winston Churchill. He always comes top. You should tell your children and grandchildren two things about Winston Churchill. Well, maybe three things if you're a Welsh miner. But two things. One thing, he thinks the Palestinians were like dogs. He said to the Peel Commission in 1937, because a dog has lain in a manger for a very long time, I do not give that dog the right to the manger. If a superior, more worldly race comes along and displaces them, then tough titty. Well, I paraphrased the last bit, but you know, tough, move on. That's what he said. I have no sympathy for the North American Indians or the Palestinians. Pretty disgusting, racist drivel, yeah? Secondly, he's the man who said, if you tell your children about the greatest living Briton, you might not be so proud to be British afterwards. I don't know if this appears in the asylum seeker's test of British values. But he's the man who said, I deplore squeamishness about the use of poison gas. I recommend the use of poison gas against uncivilized tribes. Said that in 1918 when Britain was first of all making the acquaintance of the Iraqis. So this barbarism and savagery goes back a long time. Blair and Cameron are just the most recent inheritors of this disgusting tradition. But look, friend, it means repression at home as night follows day. If they start butchering Iraqis and supporting Israelis, people, decent people here oppose it and they have to be repressed. We got tribal racism. And you know, it was just funny. It was very, very funny because, but I'll tell you why it's very serious as well afterwards. But it's funny because I told a Chinese friend of mine at university where I work, I said, I've been done for racism. I worked with a lot of Chinese students. I was really gratified because she shrieked with laughter and ran up the corridor and said, Mick's been charged with racism. Right. You know, not, well, we knew that. Well, of course, they had it coming. He's all, no, it was quite gratifying. But the five of us are lifelong anti-racists. And we waited and waited and waited. They first of all tried to fit us up as Jew haters. They charged us with shouting against Jews. Well, the BBC Radio 3 had recorded the entire event. So we produced the recording, no mention of Jews. Nothing, zilch, nada, nothing. So they have to drop the charges. By the way, you don't mind me telling the story again. I think it's very illuminating. This is getting ridiculous, you know. Ridiculous. There was a fantastically good meeting down in SOAS in London a few months ago. And some Zionist halfwit called Hoffman came along and disrupted it. A lot of the Jews and Gentiles in the audience, they're all great people, but really pissed off with this guy. And they barracked him. They said, shut up, Hoffman, we know what you're like. And one of them, you know, and the BBC reported he was the victim of anti-Semitic abuse. Do you know why? The BBC website ran the story. It ran the story. I'm telling you, I'm not making this up. Somebody shouted, Hoffman, do you really believe that? I swear I'm not making it up. And we say now, don't ever ask somebody at the bus stop if there's a bus Jew, because if you do that, you'll be weaked off. You have no chance. You have to hope his name's not Moshe, because you have no chance. It's ludicrous. So we were charged with racism. We waited for week after month. We went to court 24 times. What the hell's? What's the case? The Jewish thing is dropped. So what's the case? And the sheriff's waiting, and suddenly the procurator official reveals his hand. It is racist and unlawful to say these words, genocide in Gaza. Even on a public street, it is unlawful and racist. Because everybody knows geography and they know the only people that could be doing it are Israelis, and that's anti-Semitic. Now, the sheriff came back a week later and he was satirical. He said, but this means you good people will have to march around the streets of Edinburgh carrying placards which say, boycott an unspecified Middle Eastern state. genocide in an unnamed Middle Eastern state. I mean, you don't usually get Scottish judges, sheriffs, being funny. You know, they rarely crack a smile, but this was funny. And he said, the attempts to squeeze hatred out of what we were saying was very strained, he said. So look, the question is, why does this procurator fiscal, why does he do this? Why does he risk ridicule? It's very simple. There was the London conference in February 2009. Dennis McShane was there. Sadiq Khan went there for Hazel Blair's. And they all applauded denunciations of extremism. They were united to a man and woman against extremism. You could find Natan Sharansky denouncing extremism. Sharansky was a Zionist ultra who denounced Ariel Sharon for being too soft on the people of Gaza. And he was there applauding denunciations of extremism. So it's a kind of wacky environment. They accepted a definition of anti-Semitism that makes you, every single one of you, a racist, and probably a granny as well. If you critique Israel on democratic grounds, I don't believe in a Jewish state. I don't want a Muslim state. If you want a Muslim state, we'll have to fight. I certainly don't want a Christian state, for God's sake. Franco had one of those. I don't want any sectarian state. But if I criticise the state of Israel and say it should be the state of all its citizens, all of them, not Jews living in Vladivostok or bloody Sheffield, nothing against Sheffield, sorry, but of all its citizens, including 22% Arabs, that is anti-Semitic. It really is thought crime. It's actually thought crime. And if you think this is wacky, the National Union of Students just renewed their commitment to this definition for another year. The National Union of Students signs up to this complete insanity. So why did the Edinburgh Procurator Fiscal do us for racism? He must have thought it would look good in his CV to be the first. Oh, by the way, Gordon Brown signed the London Declaration. So the Prime Minister has signed this complete insanity, so you can forgive the Edinburgh prosecutor if he thinks he can improve his career. Look, in Swansea, they tried racial charge. I think it was for a racist assault on some oranges. Some Swansea Palestine activists were initially charged with racially aggravated, but they withdrew it. A young woman in France, Sakina, has been convicted of a racially aggravated offence for putting a boycott sticker on a bottle of orange juice in a Carrefour supermarket. I mean, that's what's happening. They're not going to give up. The repression will continue. And of course, it's a qualitative leap for these young guys in London. We enjoyed our legal procedure because we were five, we were 50 really, but five of us in court, we were organised, we had fantastic lawyers. I mean, we had some absolute numpties as well at the beginning, but later on we got some really sharp cookies, really sharp. For 2 days they're up debating and destroying the opposition, and I felt I had a role in a small mini-series written by a great scriptwriter. It was absolutely brilliant, really razor sharp. It was enjoyable. Okay, hope. There's a lot of hope. Israeli goods do not go into Durban port. The dockers there refuse to handle Israeli goods. As soon as they identify any Israeli goods, the ships get turned away. The Israeli can kill his family, but he can't kill South African dockers. Not unless they want something but very bad to happen to them. They cannot do it. The Scottish TUC has committed to active boycott. Active, right across the board, boycott. Scottish First Minister said in Question Time 3-4 weeks ago, they're using British passports to suffocate men in Dubai hotel rooms. After what Israel's done, you can't treat it as a normal state. And that includes a review of trade relations. The Methodist Church, I can reveal as an exclusive, because I spoke to a guy yesterday who just got it, has just committed to boycott of settlement goods, and they're opening the door to a more general boycott, but they're not there yet. The Israelis said Europe's anti-Semitic, because opinion poll after opinion poll after opinion poll for about 9 years now, the last one was 3 weeks ago, published by the BBC World Service, Israel is a polecat state in terms of world public opinion. No ifs, no buts. Jeez, the exceptions are America and poor sod in Kenya. I mean, as if Kenyans don't have enough trouble, they're the only ones in the world that are, you know, not so critical of Israel. But right across the planet, Israel is bad news to ordinary people. Not in terms of public discourse, not in terms of institutions, but when you ask people what they think. And that makes me fantastically optimistic that we can build a really successful boycott campaign. The EU has accepted the Goldstone report. The Goldstone report calls for Israel to go to the International Criminal Court if they refuse to clean up their act. And there's no way Harold Shipman was going to stop, and there's no way the Israelis are going to stop their mass killing either. So that's a mandate for you and me to go out and say Israel should go to the International Criminal Court. And if you think Scotland's particularly radical, believe me, I live there, I know it's not. And Ron Prosser, the Israeli ambassador, knows it as well. In the Times last week, Prosser said, "We have great relations with the British government." That was the last one. He said, "The British people are a problem. The British people are demonising Israel," he said. "The British people are demonising Israel." And he's right. He's right. We're not demonising it. We're just saying they're killing lots of children. And they're pouring sewage on Palestinian villages from settlements. And dropping white phosphorus on people. So Prosser knows wherever he goes, whether it's a wee town in Scotland or anywhere in England, he doesn't go there like the Dutch ambassador or the Spanish. He gets challenged by people who stand up for human rights. He knows that. Al Morgan Lipney cancelled her last visit to Britain. She feared arrest. Doron Almog, if you remember, landed at Heathrow and took off pretty quickly. You've had a bad experience with the Metropolitan Police, and I'll tell you stories about them later. But Doron Almog, they were waiting with handcuffs for Doron Almog because people had got an arrest warrant issued, and his El Al plane took off because the Brits shut up. Okay. Sit down. Okay. My final piece of good news, and it really is good news. It really is good news. You know, this is not the time to be, you know, thinking about your normal life and the mortgage and the kids and so on. You know the story about the two guys in front of the firing squad? One guy says to the other, "We should ask for a blindfold, I think." And the other one says, "Look, don't cause any trouble." Now, that's where we are. That's where we are. They've invaded Iraq. They're devastating Afghanistan. They're supporting Israel. And they're making the world an extremely dangerous place. Extremely dangerous. Very dangerous indeed. And we have to do something. And I think what we have to do should be inspired by what happened in Derry. Do you know what happened in Derry? Well, I'm going to make your day now. I'm going to make your day. You'll be glad you came here tonight. While Israel was dropping 250,000, I think that's an understatement, I think it was 500,000 cluster bombs on South Lebanon in 2006, the anti-war group and the Palestine great guys in Derry said enough of these speeches. They went up the road to the Raytheon plant. It's an armaments factory. They broke into the plant. They went into the main offices. They threw computers out of the third floor window. They smashed up the computers. They did as much damage as they possibly could. And I can tell you, they did so much damage there was nothing else they could do. So they sat down and played cards. It's true, actually. They waited for Robocops, and the Robocops came. Yeah. This is Northern Ireland. Robocops came. And they dragged Eamon McCann away. He's quite a funny guy. They're dragging him away. He said, "I had 3 sevens." Eamon's that kind of guy. He's that kind of guy. You'll hear his name, by the way, because the £400 million inquiry into the Bloody Sunday Massacre is going to be released any day now. It was held back for the elections. Anyway, what happened? The Brits moved the trial from Derry to Belfast. Get them away from their family. Belfast isn't a centre of progressive thought. The jury unanimously found them not guilty. The jury said to them, "Go home. What you did was a good and wonderful thing. Smash up an armaments factory. We will support you because Israel is dropping cluster bombs on innocent people in Lebanon and murdering people across." Now, what does this say to you? You join up the dots at the level of public opinion. Let the force be with you. At the level of public opinion, it's with us. It is not with the Zionists. I mean, the BBC gave a platform to, what's his name? Griffiths, the BNP creature on Question Time. He didn't miss an opportunity to say they were the most determined supporters of Operation Cast Lead. They were determined supporters of Israel. They've gone quiet on hating Jews. I mean, they hate Jews probably, but they don't want to talk about it. They're so attracted to the murderous state of Israel. They can't resist the blood and the mayhem. So they're great supporters of Israel, the BNP. And I'll tell you, they're not the only one. In years of campaigning, Whenever I feel tired, right, I just think about the quality of the opposition. Really. It's usually nutters. I mean, I don't want to offend any Christians, because my mother was a lovely Christian. But, you know, when you're doing a stall on the street, they come up to you and they've got a special look in their eye. And the first thing they say is, you know, God gave Israel to the Jews, you know. Next, right? Because, but in years and years and years of campaigning, I'm making a serious point. All the good people are with us. All of them. All of them. And the people who are against us are either more interested. A lot of people are just interested in shopping. They don't. If they were shooting people across the road, they would carry on with their shopping. But in terms of those who think about the wider picture, the quality of the opposition is the greatest thing we've got. And my final point is, because the chair's really good, our sons and daughters have been jailed. You can't leave them. Because if you leave them, they'll go away with a bitter taste in their mouth and they'll never do anything again. Yeah. If we do swing behind them, not just a fiver and then go home, but do a fundraiser, get the raffle tickets out, to the limit of our ability, then we can really ratchet things up. I'm old enough to have been involved in a campaign against the war in Vietnam. 3 million dead, Agent Orange. I won't go there. But it was repression that made the movement. You know, there was a debate in University of Barclay a couple of weeks ago about boycott, and it was just fabulous because Barclay was the key place where the anti-Vietnam movement took off, because they were repressed. The university authority said no more anti-war meetings on this campus. Whoom! The free speech movement. Mario Savio, you might know the name, right? And it just took off. And meetings that were 10 became 100, and the meetings that were 50 became 500. Like, okay, Chair. I have to tell you about Dennis, Judge Dennis. I really need to. And if the chair, if you stop me, I'll sit down.
My popular demand.
If you want me blubbering on your hands, then make me sit down. Look, this is really important. These men have been industrially processed for 2 years, 18 months, and so on. Judge Dennis does it. Judge Dennis was put in office by Jack Straw. He recommended him to the Queen. Right? I remember Jack Straw. When a plane was hijacked from Kabul to Stansted Airport, brown-skinned people with beards and so on were sitting in the airport. Who the hell would go back to Kabul if you could stay in London? So they applied for asylum. You'd have to be completely mad not to. Kabul was devastated. Straw said, we must get them out. We must make it, you know, this is a terrible threat, you know, 200 brown-skinned people landing in London. 3 months later, Mugabe was getting heavy with the white farmers in Zimbabwe. Jack Straw instituted a special fast-track procedure to bring in white people from Zimbabwe. He's a racist ratbag. That's all he is. He recommended Judge Dennis. Now, Judge Dennis is sending these guys down. Judge Dennis had somebody else in his court last year. Very interesting case. This guy, in a hit-and-run accident, killed a cop and then ran away. He ran away. He was found guilty of dangerous driving, blah, blah. And the Israeli soldier, because he was an Israeli soldier, got 200 hours of community service for killing a cop in London last year. By Judge Dennis. By severe Judge Dennis. We must give out deterrent sentences. There was a community service. Kill a cop. It's okay. That's the reality of what we've got. It's unspeakable. It's unbearable. We have to do something about it. Dennis has to go. And I don't think we should be defensive about this campaign. These are fantastic young men who are in prison and maybe some women. They're fantastic. That's not an issue. But we have to be with them and go after Judge Dennis and say this. They might start releasing them now, and who would stay in prison if they could get out with a tag? But we will overturn every single conviction, however long it takes. Even after they're out of prison, we'll overturn those convictions. We won't allow Judge Dennis to besmirch and stain these young guys' reputations. They are the best of their generation. If we had a million people like those young men, maybe we won't be in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And my final point is this. Gandhi said it very well. He said, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. That's the four stages. Then you win. But the third stage divides into two. We have been tested by this. Every single one of us has been challenged. If we fail this test, we don't get to stage four. We go back to stage two. And we have to stand our ground here. And it really is critically important that they do not send Muslims down while we get on with normal life, that they do not make these young men despair and turn to whatever they turn to because they think the world's forgotten about them. Thank God the Palestinians haven't done that, and they still... I'll sit down by saying this. We got a letter from Palestine last week, and, you know, just sometimes you get a lump in your throat. We're organising something, trivial little thing, and you get a letter from Palestinian people in Gaza. You know what they say? They say, thank you for your solidarity. Thank you for your solidarity. They say from Gaza, they say, we will try not to let you down. What the hell is the world like, eh? What the hell is the world like? We're ruled by Cameron and Brown and Blair and other rodents who are mercilessly torturing the people of Gaza, and they have the humanity and the gigantic stature to say to us, we'll try not to let you down. Well, they can't possibly let us down, but we shouldn't let these young men down, and we shouldn't let down the people of Gaza either.
Thank you very much, Mick. Thank you. Before we take questions, I'd like to make...